First Chronicles. Let me show you some of the things of the board. I'd like to begin. First Chronicles 28 and 29, not First Kings. First Chronicles, where we'll start, where mostly be elsewhere, but I do want to use this passage for a particular purpose. I'd invited you to think ahead about Hezekiah for tonight if you had had a time for that during the week. And so we'll be looking at 2 Chronicles 29 through 32 for most of our time. And I mentioned Jehoshaphat for next week for those who'd like to read ahead. Again, you're welcome to make the king's comparison. And so I have mentioned the king's passage here to, if you want to go of the comparative mode and see how the two accounts differ. It's pretty interesting the way they differ. We might turn to that if you have an initiative that takes us in that direction. Then on the up here, these initials were present last week, and I had a question about it, but I never got to it, so I want to make sure I start with it tonight. It seemed like to me that these initials, the words they represent, really to establish a focus for this book. The book, it seems like the chronicler is very much interested in focusing on David, Jerusalem, and the temple. Those three things are represented by those initials. And it's one of the reasons in the first class I asked you to understand the presence of a Davidic frame. And I hope we'll see that tonight with Hezekiah, for example. And then it's pretty clear that this, in the period, if we understand the book to have been written in restoration time, then you can see how restoring the temple, restoring the city, restoring this Davidic ideal, is you can see that being looming large as its purpose in the book. So we'll get to that. And here is our standard prophet's diagram we might come back to if you have initiative. But let's go to 1 Chronicles 28 right now. I want to call your attention to just a couple of references here, but I do this to show you, or to at least suggest, how persistent is the reference to the condition of the heart. Remember, the centerpiece of our second class was this tug of war between according to the rule and with the whole heart. And you mess up, it seems to me, if you hold on to one to the exclusion of the other. It cannot be an either or. It has to be a both and. It has to be this active engagement, the intertwining of acting according to the rule and acting with the whole heart. And remember, we got the language of the acting according to the rule by the references to Uzzah. The story of Uzzah is standard fare for presenting how important it is to God that things be done in a certain way. And that's where we got the quoted phrase, David said, "We did not do it according to the rule." So that matters. But that's not all that matters. We want to be aware of this other side too. So in 1 Chronicles 28, beginning in verse 9, "And you, Solomon, my son," here we have David's charge to his son, talking to him about what he needs to do, "know the God of your father and serve him." Know and serve. I would say we'd do pretty well to follow those two active verbs, know and serve. But notice the qualification given to the servant: serve with a whole heart. See, the way you serve matters. It's not enough to serve fussily and perfunctorily, reluctantly and hesitantly. It's whatever it means to have a whole heart, that's the goal. And then it goes on to say, and with a willing mind. So that those two, we might think about what's the relationship between a whole heart and a willing mind. Just to extend that, if you look at verse 21, the last verse of the chapter, and behold, the divisions of the priests and the Levites for all the service of the house of God, and with you and all the work will be every willing man who has skill. Notice that that combination, this is the same language that's used about Bezalel when the tabernacle was built in Exodus 36 and 37. Bezalel has the skill to do the building. He has the craftsman's skill, but he's also a willing man. That word willing comes in. In fact, in Exodus, his heart is specifically mentioned. All right, turn over to chapter 29 with me, and we're going to look just at a couple of places, then we'll move on to Hezekiah. Two verses here. Look at verse 18 with me. O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, our fathers, keep forever such purposes and thoughts in the hearts of your people. See, that's what matters. Where are these things located? Are they located in our going on? And direct their hearts toward you. See, the vector of the heart matters. In some ways, you're going to have a heart. Where will it be pointed is the question. And then keep going in verse 19. Grant to Solomon, my son, a whole heart, that he may keep your commandments, your testimonies, and your statutes performing all. Notice how keeping and obeying and is tied to have the condition of your heart. So I suggest to you that we have language here, and this is certainly not the only place, but we do see it here. See language where the pairing is offered to us. Obedience and the willing heart. So let's now go to the Hezekiah passage in 2 Chronicles. That's so here we go to 2 Chronicles chapter 29. Just pretty impressive, just the extent, the expansiveness here of Hezekiah's part. I want to remind you that here in this part, at least in good part here, we're invited to learn through story, by story, with story. And we can talk about that some if you have questions. We can think about how is it that we learn? What is it that the story way of knowing offers us that's different from, say, a direct command? All right, so this is a way of knowing. And so we're invited to learn about God. And I think it's suited to what we talked about last week, where covenant is the central mechanism of God's acting with it. And covenant is best understood through a story, the living of the covenant. There's no other way. There's no other way to have a covenant without enacting it. It has to be storied. It has to be lived out. It can't merely be a souvenir on a shelf, a memento, a certificate, some kind of formal piece collecting dust. It has to be lived out. And when you live it out, you have a story. So I just invite you to think about that. Okay.
Randy?
Yes.
Verse 19, and give to my son Solomon a perfect heart to keep thy commandments.
Right. All right. And yours, instead of whole, yours says perfect heart, all right? And so, and the test of the perfect heart is keeping commandments. So there we have them joined together, the juxtaposing of heart and willed obedience. Thank you for that.
Which God tries the heart.
Okay.
And he does in us too.
Right. Do we? Who's, anybody got the New Testament reference where we, where that language is used? Somebody think about that, we'll come back to it in a minute. God tries the heart. Thank you for that. Anyone else want to join in for the moment, all right? I remind you that our lesson one asserted the role of the Davidic frame. It's important that every king is seen in relation to David, right? So he's the measure. And so, and I use the word frame because almost without exception, there may be some, but generally the stories begin and end with the language. It's almost like a bracket or parentheses to the story. How do they stand in relation to David? That's the test, right? So here we see that, I'm in chapter 29 and verse 2, and he receives the praise here, right? He sees, and he, this is Micaiah, did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that David his father had done. See, there's the test. How does he measure up to David? And here, this is favorable. Remember, Jehoram, not so favorable. And that's announced at the beginning. And at the end of the Jehoram story, we saw in the very first class, how he is buried in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the others. So again, there's a geography of burial that matters. And we see the same thing here. So go to the end. Now let's go to the end of verse of chapter 32 and see what is told to us about the end of Hezekiah. If it's not the last verse, it's right near the end. Oh, yes, right there. 32, 33. What's the different detail we're given? If I'm right to emphasize the geography of burial.
He was buried in the tombs of David.
Now, he's in the tomb, that's right. But there's more. There's gravy on that country basket. In here. What is the more?
The upper parts.
And see, I take it to be one of the features of learning by story is you work every detail you've got. See, there is, I don't know, it may not be significant that the location of the tomb matters, but I'm wondering if there's not a hierarchy of placement within the tomb. We get some hint of that just because we know Jehoram, where he's placed matters. And so here a reference to place is given, and I'm assuming that it's similarly matters, but here matters favorably, buried in the upper part of the tombs of the sons of David. So again, the frame is intact. We're given that. Now, I'm going to stop for a minute. When your initiative falters, I'm going to take you through. I'm going to ask you to see where obedience, where heart is found, where covenant is found, the things we've seen generally. Can we take those tools that we're developing and apply them here to the Hezekiah story? But I'm going to stop for a minute because I hope that somebody has brought their own initiative from your reading of these chapters this week and want to pick out something. Or if not, you can just be a quick grabber right now and grab something to talk about. Remember, I always recommend identifying verbs. Yes, go ahead, Mel.
I think one of the things that constantly stands out to me as I read the Kings, the Chronicles, is, you know, as a parent, I always, you know, my goal is to set my children up to be better than I was, to be, you know, more in tune with the Lord than I am, to follow that path, right? But over and over, I see that a good king is preceded by a bad king, who's preceded by a good king. Like the son doesn't always follow the father, and how, and that I'm not sure how that plays into it, or what that says.
Right. Well, thank you for suggesting that. I I substituted in David's class about prodigals, and so that's kind of an interesting merging of topics, it seems. Here, but it is right that here we have this most highly praised king, and yet his son, very different.
So was his father.
Yes, so we go, so there's not a, although, I mean, although Manasseh does abominations, he does have a repentance somewhere along the way. But you're right, that is a pattern, and I don't know what to make of it. I don't know if we could, I don't know that we can establish a causal relationships there. Go ahead.
I think in the case of the kings here, you see that the example of the kings was very important. But at some point, as the people drifted off in idolatry, their effectiveness diminished. And
okay. The
lack of leadership from the beginning led to or contributed to the decline. And then it was even the best kings, Hezekiah and Josiah, couldn't lift them up out of the sin that they were in.
All right, even the best kings could not lift the people, thank you for your vigorous word choice, lift the people out of their sin. But even, we could also say even the best kings have their own flaws. And those flaws may have been instrumental. In fact, somewhere along the way, either right now or later, somebody scouts around for it. What flaw in Hezekiah is noted? Actually, I may be, no, it's in, I may be thinking about the king's language rather than the, rather than the Chronicles one here.
A little bit of pride, it sounds like.
Oh, it is in Chronicles, it is in the last chapter, isn't it?
32,
yeah, chapter 32, and you notice, I don't know, I'm maybe pushing this way too much, but at least I want to consider it, and that is that some sins are especially troubling in their dissolving power, and I think pride may be one of those. If this was not just an episode, but something that was more pronounced than that, than it could have been a talent. But again, we don't know that. But we do see that flaw. His heart was proud. And notice, it's not just he was proud, his heart was proud. And that is in 32:25. But Hezekiah did not make return according to the benefit done to him, for his heart was proud. What is meant by that language? But Hezekiah did not make return. That's my wording in this ESV translation. What's going on?
Render not again according to the benefit done unto him.
According to the benefit, there's a fairly brief mention here of his illness. It's much more elaborated in Kings. But here, so he it does mention he's ill and he's healed, he recovers. But what does it mean? The benefit done him is the healing, I'm sure. But did not make return or did not render.
Did it have to do with sacrifices? He should have made sacrifices of thanksgiving to God?
Well, somehow. Now, we're not told exactly what it would be. But this one thing I mentioned to you last week, is that the nature of a covenant. The covenant is reciprocal. Someone gives a gift, and the one who receives the gift has an obligation to respond, because that's what you do in a covenant. Now, there's no presumption that you're returning equal for equal, because then that's not the nature of the relationship, but you do have an obligation to return, and the proper return, I mentioned last week is gratitude. And there's some question whether or not Hezekiah, I think that's what he means, he did not make return. See, to make return would be to offer back the gift in return, the gift of gratitude. Now, whether that might be in the form of sacrifice or prayer, we're not told that. All right, thank you. Yes?
There's a therefore in there, and just before the therefore, it says his heart was lifted up.
Okay.
And then following the therefore, we see this is what you get for that.
All right. Mine has that at the end. It says for his heart was proud. Yours has his heart was lifted up instead of proud.
It says
nice wording.
For his heart was lifted up.
Okay.
Therefore, there was wrath upon him.
Okay. Thank you. Therefore, I do have therefore, the wrath came upon him after that. Okay, thank you.
That's what you get for having your heart lifted up.
All right, yes, and then the very next verse said, Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart. So he did make correction. All right, thank you. So anyway, I brought this in light of Malcolm's observation, at least, of how there seems to be this almost a pattern of no pattern, or even a pattern of opposite from what you expect from a good king son.
You emphasize the importance of every detail.
Yes.
And I would like to pick at this.
Pick it. Keep picking.
Chief, this chiefest of the sepulchers. Now, I know.
Where are you in this?
That's in the verse 33 of chapter 32 that you mentioned earlier.
Okay, 32, 33. Thank you. Go ahead.
Chiefest of sepulchers. I know that the person deceased doesn't benefit. I reckon it's not him that it benefits. You can be proud while you're laying dead in that sepulcher now.
Oh, right.
I don't think so.
No, I take that to be the sign of the honor in which he was held by others.
To his family. Maybe.
Right. Well, to it is a recognition that he is a king most like David.
And in a way, a confirmation that his behavior is something that you should emulate?
Well, I think you could say that. That's what the placement shows approval. Be like him.
Now, who decided?
We're not told that. We're not told how the. Yeah, that's. But good. I pester the details. I appreciate that. But are you reading King James?
Yes.
The sepulcher's got to. You got to get King James with that.
Good work. So.
Okay. So thank you. We've looked at a couple of particular places, the beginning and end of the Hezekiah story, the frame, and then we've looked at this detail about this flaw, at least an episode of the lifted up heart. Someone else want to grab hold of some detail from the Hezekiah story for us to consider?
Well, I don't know how much we can draw from it, but as I pointed out, that Manasseh began reigned when he was 12. Hezekiah was given 15 more years. So Manasseh was born after Hezekiah was spared.
Oh, okay.
And somewhere in that 15 years, Hezekiah's flaw may have influenced or contributed to Manasseh.
Well, thank you for, again, we've kind of limited how far we can push this, but I do appreciate the being attentive to the chronology there. Thank you. I just let that pass, so I'm grateful for your close reading. 15 years extension, and that's not actually mentioned here, but it's in the King's Version, and then the son is 12 when he rules. Okay. Thank you for that. More. Keep going. Yes.
Just another one of those details. When you look at that verse 33, he says he was buried in the upper tombs of the sons of David.
Yes.
I flipped over a couple chapters to when Josiah dies, and it's interesting because it says, chapter 35, verse 24, so he died and was buried in one of the tombs of his fathers. And that, it's just peculiar that for Hezekiah, it says
David's
the sons
name.
Of David.
Right.
Versus, and, you know, the tombs of their fathers,
right,
or any of the other.
That's actually, when, back in 33, when Hezekiah, his death is actually referred to as sleeping with his fathers. So that's pretty traditional language, right? The king slept with the fathers. But it is, so in that sense, I would say that's kind of that's the standard line. And the chronicler, at least frequently, gives this added emphasis by naming David, because he is, his one of his overriding purposes is to renew the Davidic ideal. This is God's king. I want to connect to the past because I also want to look ahead to the new David who's coming. Right? So that's why we want this Davidic emphasis. Because God is going to have a king like David. We know to remember how David, that was a weirdo. I think I'll forget that note. So let's keep anybody else. Thank you, Malcolm, for adding to our consideration. Yes.
And one of his characteristics that was really good about him being the king, not only was he a good leader, because he restored the temple, he encouraged the Levites to sanctify themselves again and purify themselves, but he was a man of prayer. So, because when Sennacherib came and he took Israel into captivity, and then they tried to take Judah, he went into the temple and he prayed. It's
32:20. Okay. Thank you. So, thank you. Let's go ahead and I'm going to read that prayer in just a moment. But let's go ahead and emphasize this, Antoinette's point. What a couple of things about it. One that I'm grateful because I was seeing that in another light that you mentioned, but I was not thinking about it so much as his personal characteristic. So you've helped me think about it more richly, that the one of the ways he becomes David's son, heir of David, king like David, is that he prays like David, right? But then also notice this, where does the prayer take place? He goes to the temple to do it. See, so there again, there's a centrality of it. The geography here, not just a geography of burial, it is also a geography here of prayer that matters. Okay, I'm going to say in verse 20, then Hezekiah the king and Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos, prayed because of this and cried to heaven. And the Lord sent an angel who cut off all the mighty warriors and commanders and officers in the camp of the king of Assyria. So he returned with shame, with shame face to his own land. When he came into the house of his God, some of his own sons struck him down there with the sword. So the Lord saved Hezekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, king of Assyria, and from the hand of all his enemies. And he provided for them on every side. And then he brought gifts to the Lord to Jerusalem and precious things to Hezekiah, king of Judah, so that he was exalted in the sight of all the nations from that time forth. So the king is exalted. Notice what it says here. They brought gifts to the Lord to Jerusalem again. So again, it didn't have to be there, but it's mentioned up. Where, as I was reading, I didn't notice a reference to the temple right there. Did I miss it?
I don't think it's in Chronicles.
Oh, you're talking about the King's Version?
It gets better detailed.
King's a lot fuller prayer, isn't it?
Correct. 2 Kings 19:1-34.
Okay, the whole prayer is all that?
That's what he said more.
Okay.
My footnote says you get a better detail at that location.
Let me suggest how this, in one sense, I don't have an answer, and it may not matter, but if we're seeing the chronicler here in the world of restoration following captivity, and he's emphasizing David and Jerusalem and the temple, why doesn't he mention the temple and the other? Now, it may not be the same occasion, but it seems like it is. Let's just start reading and see. So he tore his clothes in verse 1 and covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of the Lord. But the prayers over here in 14. He went up to the house of the Lord again. And look what he did. What did he do with this, with the letter?
Laid it out before God.
Yours has laid it out there. Okay, mine's just spread it. Yeah. But the details matter. It's important to take taking this burden, taking it to the place where God has said He would meet us, and I'm spreading it out. I'm laying it out in front of Him. And we think about doing that kind of verbally, but here we get this visual reinforcement. And Hezekiah prayed before the Lord and said, O Lord, the God of Israel, enthroned above the cherubim, You are the God, You alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Incline Your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open Your eyes, O Lord, and see. Hear the words of Sennacherib, which He has sent to mock the living God. Truly, O Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste the nations and their lands and have cast their gods into the fire. For they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore, they were destroyed. So now, O Lord our God, save us, please, from His hand, that all the kings of the earth may know that You, O Lord, are God alone. All right. I'm really interested, because it seems to me that those details of the prayer would fit well in the Second Chronicles, but for some reason they are not included. All right? We do get some of that. Let's keep going. Thank you for calling attention to a characteristic of this. I think I was kind of pushing the point from the King's passage. Another feature is not only is he a man of prayer, but he is a temple-centered ruler. He doesn't, this is not going out in the desert place to pray, but he goes to the house. Okay.
Brent,
yes?
Just one other aspect that kind of aligns him with David. He seeks Isaiah. He seeks the prophet. He seeks for the speaker of the Lord when he has... When he has a problem, the same thing David did.
Right.
He was always inquiring of the Lord.
And how was Saul different?
Saul did whatever Saul wanted to do.
He seeks advice elsewhere, right? That's what gets him in trouble. So thank you again for collecting more details. All right, I'm going to ask people. I've seen it. I see it about 5 or 6 times at least in this passage on. I invite you just to scout through there, just to skim over the text, looking for the word heart. And I think you'll find it there several times in 2 Chronicles 29 through 32. So he's, once you see one, some of you might even jump ahead and start later. Junior high students are pretty good at word searching jobs. Y'all are slipping here now. At least six times. One of the times is that negative one where his pride is in his heart. But I am in chapter 29, and I see in verse 10. Here we get a combo. It is in my heart to make a covenant. You understand that? Yeah, I want to do like God. I want to work the way God does. I want to work through covenant. So this is a way to make things right with God, is to make covenant. By the way, this is related to the chronicler understands that David is a covenant, or David wants to make a covenant, makes a covenant with God. And here Hezekiah does the same thing. And the way you live the covenant is to practice your obedience. The way you live the covenant is to restore the worship of God in the temple. And so we saw David in 1 Chronicles doing all this organizing. And the same thing is going on here. There is this conspicuous effort to organize worship, to arrange schedules, just like our food coordinators do. There is an organization that goes on. Yes, you look like you're bidding on the couch.
Yeah. Anyway, in 31:21 it says, "In every work which you began in the of service in the house of God, in law and in commandment, seeking his God, he did with his heart and prospered." So that's that, like you said, that tug of war, that balance between laws and commandments and the heart.
Okay, good. And here it is, the service of the house of God. See, we're going to get this service right. And that's going to be pleasing to God. Now here again, I don't think that we should not start thinking about this as earning, but I would simply say living a relationship. Right? Remember my standard example that I repeated. There's no husband in this room who would dare say, "I don't want you to think I'm trying to earn something from you, so I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to sit here in my chair and love you." How well is that going to work? Not very well, right? Because if you make a covenant, we simply, it's just a normal expectation that you enact it, that you live it, not that you're earning anything, right? You understand that. But again, thank you for getting that language at the last verse of chapter 31. Seeking his God, he did with all his heart. We get the language, the positive work of the heart there. There can be a few more details. I invite some of you to look back over the section. I will at least in a review fashion bring up a bit of this, but we'll also compare it to Jehoshaphat. We'll look at one piece, 1 Chronicles 19. This was a phrase we came across last week, and I got a text message in the middle of class. I didn't know what was happening. I didn't see it till later. But Dale had texted 19:2, 1 Chronicles 19:2. David says, "I will deal kindly with Hannah." That was a phrase. That's that covenant phrase that Rahab uses and Ruth uses. And here, David uses, "I'm going to deal kindly. I'm going to practice God's steadfast love. I'm going to practice Hesed." Let's close in prayer. Holy God, Thank you for your words. Thank you for our company tonight. Help us to take these words and ponder them and meditate on them. Help us be like Hezekiah's, people who pray, spreading things before you. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.